start. Right, we now come to deal with the temptations, the testing of Jesus. And as in so many other instances, we are confronted with three texts, two long ones, Matthew and Luke, and one short one in Mark. Now, when you encounter that type of situation where there's a serious discrepancy in the length of the texts, then you focus on the longer texts and leaving the shorter one completely aside. We'll encounter exactly the same sort of problem when dealing with the agony in the garden, where Luke's text is much shorter than that of Matthew and Mark. And you'll see the reason for this as time goes on. So we focus our attention, therefore, on Matthew and on Luke. The first and our major concern is to determine which of these two is the more primitive. Did Matthew draw on Luke, or did Luke draw on Matthew? Or did both draw on a common source, the famous Q source? If so, the question is, which represents Q more authentically? The major difference between the two is the order of the temptations. If the order in Matthew is 1, 2, 3, that is, stones into bread, the pinnacle of the temple, and the high mountain, all the kingdoms of the world, the order in Luke is 1, 3, 2, where you have first stones into bread, then the high mountain, all the kingdoms of the world, and finally the pinnacle of the temple in Jerusalem. Now, in general terms, it's much more likely that Luke has changed Matthew than the other way around. And the reason for this is that Luke likes things to culminate in Jerusalem. Remember that his whole gospel is constructed on a journey to Jerusalem. From chapter 9 onwards, Jesus is on his way up to Jerusalem. And in the second volume, the Acts of the Apostles, everything radiates out from Jerusalem. You will be my witnesses in Jerusalem, in Judea, and in Samaria, to the ends of the earth. So that it's, as I say, a priori, more likely that Luke changed the order in order to have the series of three rather extraordinary stories culminate in Jerusalem, to have the climax in Jerusalem. Now, there are a couple of other little hints which confirm that conclusion. If you look at verse 3 in both Matthew and Luke, Matthew has, "And the tempter came and said to him, if you are the Son of God, order these stones to become bread." Immediately, to any familiar with the Middle East, that conjures up an absolutely absurd image. Because, of course, there are stones everywhere. You'd have a desert full of loaves. But, of course, turn these stones into bread is a very natural way of talking. But look what Luke has. "If you are the Son of God, order this stone to become bread." It's much more likely that Luke has changed the plural of Matthew than that Matthew has changed the plural of Luke. The second is verse 8 of Matthew and verse 5 of Luke. In Matthew, again, the devil took him up to a very high mountain. That reference to a very high mountain does not appear in Luke. Why? Because for Jews, the high mountain was Jerusalem. It wasn't the highest, even in the immediate vicinity, but symbolically, it was the mountain of the Lord and the mountain to which none other could compare. This is a hint that Luke is concentrating all his attention on Jerusalem. In verse 9, of Luke. He took him to Jerusalem. See the corresponding text in verse 5 of Matthew, the devil took him to the holy city. Now everybody knows that the holy city is Jerusalem. But it's much more likely that Luke would change holy city to the very explicit Jerusalem than the other way around. So in other words, you have a whole series of indicators which suggest that by comparison with Matthew, Luke is secondary. Okay? So we focus our attention on Matthew. To read Matthew's account, one very quickly realizes that the three stories, the three tests, have a common denominator. In each one, Jesus is victorious by virtue of a quotation from the Old Testament. But if you look at the references, you will recognize that all three quotations come from the same book of the Old Testament, namely the book of Deuteronomy. And if you look even more closely, you will recognize that the references appear in inverse order to the order of Deuteronomy. The first quotation is from Deuteronomy chapter 8, verse 3. The second is from Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 16. And the third is from Deuteronomy 6, 13. So you have 6:13 going backwards, 6:13, the third, 6:16, the second, and 8:3, the first. Now remember the old rule, once or twice is happenstance, the third time it's enemy action. If someone bumps you in a supermarket, that's all right, that happens. If second time the same person bumps you, that could still be an accident, but if the third time the same person bumps you, then you know it's deliberate. In other words, once you go beyond three, coincidence is no longer an adequate explanation. That may work for one or two, but not for three. So when you find this sort of concentration, the same book, and the order inverted, then the author is telling us very clearly that the clue to what is going on in this story is to be found in the book of Deuteronomy. Now, Deuteronomy, you will remember, is the narrative, the reflective narrative, on the Exodus from Egypt, the great saving event of the people. And if you look at the first temptation plus the introduction, you will see very close contacts with Deuteronomy. Then Jesus was led up by the Spirit into the desert to be tested by the devil, and he fasted 40 days and 40 nights, and afterwards he was hungry. And the tempter came and said to him, "If you are the Son of God, order these stones to become bread." Now look at the context from which Jesus' quote is taken, which is at the top of page 7. And the underlined words are words that appear in these first two verses of Matthew's account. "You shall remember all the way which the Lord your God has led you these 40 years in the wilderness." Now we have the Spirit, remember. Jesus was led by the Spirit into the wilderness desert, to be the same thing, to be tested. "To know what was in your heart, whether you would keep his commandments. And he humbled you and let you hunger." And there I just put in a note so that the verb ana can also be tempted and pointed to cause to fast, because Jesus fasted 40 days, remember? "And let you hunger," because he was thereafter, he was hungry. "And fed you with manna, which you did not know, nor did your fathers know, that he might make you know that one does not live by bread alone, but that one lives by everything that proceeds out of the mouth of the Lord. Your clothing did not wear out upon you, and your foot did not swell these 40 years. Know then in your heart that as a person disciplines a son, the Lord your God disciplines you." Now here, once again, there are far too many contacts for coincidence. lead, 40, wilderness, testing, fasting, hunger, the quotation, and son, if you are the son of God. Now, 8 contacts, far too many for coincidence, and remember that every reader of the original story would have immediately heard the resonances of the language in which the story is being told. Now, what is the first test about? Very often, it is understood to be the abuse of messianic powers. The idea being that Jesus was given a certain number of powers in order to discharge his messianic ministry, and it would have been an abuse of those powers to use them for his own gratification. Now, while that might appear to be perfectly logical, it is in no way suggested by the text. The background of Deuteronomy concerns, or suggests, that the issue concerns hunger and the satisfying of hunger, because this was a crucial element in the Exodus from Egypt. They were promised food, and they got manna and the quails. But, we're told, they lusted after the flesh pots of Egypt. The Israelites, therefore, in their attitude towards food, demonstrated that their hearts were divided. On the one hand, the good inclination was present, because they followed the Lord, the pillar of fire, the pillar of cloud, into the desert. But also the evil inclination was present, because they complained. They did not trust God to feed them. So the real message of the first test is the heart. Is the heart divided? And any rabbi to whom you mention the word stone would immediately say heart, if you play associative word games. Why? Because the heart of stone is the heart of the sinner. The second, then the devil took him up to the holy city and set him on the wing of the temple. I never know why they translate a pinnacle of the temple, because the word terugion literally means a wing. And it could be used of the wing of a building, just as we use the wing of a building. And said to him, if you are the Son of God, throw yourself down, for it is written, he will give his angels charge of you, and on their hands they will bear you up, lest you dash your foot against a stone. This is from, these two quotes are from Psalm 91, which is one of a series of psalms which reflect on the mystery of the journey through the desert from Egypt. Jesus said to him, again it is written, you shall not test the Lord your God. Now here, the key word is wing, because that was the evocative term in the great symbol of the eagle, which was used to depict God's protection of his young. Deuteronomy chapter 32, verses 11 and 12. As an eagle stirs up its nest and hovers over its young, as it spreads its wings, takes them up, and bears them aloft on its pinions, the Lord alone guided them. He set them atop the heights of the land. Now, the thought pattern here is not linear. It's associative. Words were meant to evoke not only individual texts, but their contexts. It's a very rabbinic style of writing, which exhibits an extraordinary degree of literary skill. So the second test is the test of divine protection. Does one accept and trust God, or does one refuse that trust by testing God? The temple is the locus of this, because the temple was the place of God's presence, and therefore, by definition, the place of most effective protection. So the second temptation concerns the self-preservation. The third. Again, the devil took him up to a very high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and the glory of them. And he said to him, "All these I will give you if you will fall down and worship me." Then Jesus said to him, "Begone, Satan, for it is written, you shall worship the Lord your God, and him only shall you serve." Now, in Deuteronomy chapter 3, verse 27, Moses is told, "Go to the top of Pisgah and turn your eyes westward and northward and southward and eastward. Look well, for you shall not go over the Jordan." Now the rabbis understood this text to mean that Moses saw all the kingdoms of the world. By looking in all four cardinal points, he saw, in effect, the whole world. Once going down to Tel Aviv, I was in a service taxi and noticed a sticker beside the driver which said, "Support Hate Moses Week," which I thought a little bizarre in a Jewish taxi. And I asked him about it. Now he says, when Moses was on Pisgah, if he'd turned to the left, to the right, rather than the left, we'd have the oil and they'd have the oranges. I also found out from a senior Israeli general the true explanation of why they spent 40 years in the desert. They were looking for the only country that had absolutely no oil. Now, what was the problem? This is Deuteronomy chapter 6. This again is the context from which Jesus takes his quotation. "When the Lord your God brings you into the land which he swore to your fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, that he would give you a land with great and goodly cities which you did not build, with houses full of all good things which you did not provide, with wells you did not dig, with vineyards and olive trees which you did not plant, and when you eat and are full, then take heed lest you forget the Lord who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. You shall worship the Lord your God, and him only shall you serve, and swear by his name. You shall not go after other gods, the gods of the people round about you, for the Lord your God in the midst of you is a jealous God." There, the temptation, the test, is the use and abuse of power and wealth. And, again, it's extremely evocative. You see, a high mountain would immediately have suggested idolatry. Remember the criticism of the prophets of high places. There you had illegitimate religious practices. Now this, I'm only skimming the surface of this because we only have an hour. But if you look at the cross-references in any good commentary or any good translation, then you can fill out this picture. It's meant to be extremely evocative. The texts are written with great skill to draw in a whole series. High place, idolatry, then the worship of material things, following other gods, forgetting the true God. Now these are the meanings that the original Jewish readers would have taken out of these texts. It's an extremely sophisticated parable. If such care went into the construction of the three little stories, then one would expect the same sort of care to have gone into the construction of the whole. Why three? Why not five? Why not the perfect number seven? We don't know. But we do have to try and explain why three. And the place to go, of course, is Deuteronomy. And to save time, we focus in the three chapters which are evoked by the quotations used by Jesus. Remember, two are from chapter 6, one is from chapter 8. So the first place to look is chapter 6, 7, and 8. And you don't have to read very far into chapter 6 to come across the most important triad in the whole of Jewish theology. The Shema Yisrael. Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord alone. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your might. This is the great monotheistic creed of Israel, which is found in Deuteronomy chapter 6, verses 4 and 5. The Old Testament, we read it as if it stood apart. Any Jew would have recalled those readings in the context of the interpretation that they were given in the synagogue. And here, the oldest interpretation of this triad, you shall love the Lord your God with your whole heart and with your whole soul and with all your might, is preserved in the Mishnah. Now, this is a body of legal texts and defined a parenetic text, a homiletic text in the Mishnah indicates A, that it is very old. The Mishnah was written in, was set down about 200 AD. So this is certainly much older and it is very important. And the quotation is from the tractate Berakot. You shall love the Lord with your all your heart and with all your soul and with all your might. With all your heart, that is, with both inclinations, the good inclination and the evil inclination. With all your soul, that is, even if he, God, takes away your soul. With all your might, that is, with all your wealth. Now, these are precisely the three temptations. The first, remember, the testing of the heart of Jesus. Is his heart divided or is heart whole? With all your heart, this is a rabbinic interpretation because the normal word for heart is lev, but here it's levav. And the double is used to indicate the double inclination, which is simply the way of expressing totality by the combination of opposites. Power to bind and to loose means absolute power. Here, the good intonation and the evil intonation mean totally given person. The second is, even if he takes your soul, this is, again, certainly as far back as Rabbi Akiba in the revolt of 132 to 135, when he was being tortured by the Romans, he proclaimed that now he fully understood and was grateful for the opportunity to fulfill this aspect, even if he takes your soul. That was the interpretation he had always accepted. This puts us back now to the end of the first century, so we're very close to the period of the Gospels. With all your might, that is, with all your wealth. This goes way beyond coincidence. And what we have in this parable is, in fact, a commentary on the fundamental creed that Jews accepted and which Christians took over from Jews. You shall love the Lord your God with your whole heart and with your whole soul and with all your might. Now, the recognition of this has blocked an approach to the historicity of the stories, which used to be very common. Form criticism is based on the principle that stories are retained only as long as they have a value. The second principle is that stories need a sea in which to swim, and that sea is the community. The breakthrough came with Karl Ludwig Schmidt, because what you need for progress in biblical studies are decent big wars. Because the major breakthroughs came immediately after the First World War and immediately after the Second World War. Why? Because during war, scholars have no books to read and no periodicals. So scholars are forced to read the New Testament. And inevitably then, they see things which they hadn't seen before. The beginning of critical study was in the 19th century, or even a little bit earlier, when scholars tried to get behind the division of the churches to the simple gospel of Christ. That's why there was an interest in source criticism, which was meant to be ecumenical, to enable the churches to come together on an agreed gospel. By the time of the First World War, that approach had been beaten to death. Every possible aspect, every possibility had been discussed. And so you had a crowd of young guys sitting in trenches wondering what the hell they were going to write on when it came to do their doctorate. And a whole bunch of them came up with the same idea, which was form criticism. Because what Schmidt noted was that the gospel stories are like a necklace. You have brilliant, highly colored, vivid stories, which are linked by on the next day, thereafter, some days later, very vague. So he said, let's scrub the connections. See, that left him with a whole lot of stories, which he could then shuffle around and combine. You see? He could line up all the miracle stories together and look at them to see how they agreed and disagreed. They also recognized from the work done on fairy tales, Grimm's fairy tales, that stories survived because they met a need. You see? So each story was then related to a Sitz im Leben. Life situation. It was useful to the community. It met a need of the community. Now, this story, it was argued at one stage, doesn't meet any need of the community. Because who, they say, is tempted on a regular basis to turn stones into bread? You see, one might be tempted to jump off a high building every so often, but one is never offered, certainly on a regular basis, great wealth and power. You see. So that there was a tendency on the part of people like Dupont to say, well, this is not a community creation. You see. Because the skepticism induced by Bultmann was that there's such a neat connection between the story and the needs of the community that he said, well, the community made up the story. This, if we were told, does not fit that pattern. So it must be historical. Now we know better, because in the interpretation I gave you, the temptations that lie beneath the surface are temptations which occur in everyone's life every day. The temptation to be pulled in two directions. The temptation to keep your head down and wait for a big worthy cause that will get you headlines in the newspaper. And power. And the use and abuse of power. It's something on every level that we have to deal with every day. You see. So in fact, the story, the parable, the explanation of the Shema is intimately related to the daily life of every Christian. Which raises then, in a much more acute form, the historicity of the episode. Now, what I find extraordinary is that the church focused its attention on Jesus as a victim of testing. A test implies the possibility of failure. I do not believe that in the post-resurrection period, when Jesus had been recognized as the Messiah, when the proof was that was in his resurrection, I don't believe that anyone would have thought of failure and Jesus in the same breath, except under one condition. That is, if Jesus had told them, "You will be tested as I was tested." Now, I think that's what happened. Because that hypothesis explains Mark. All we have in Mark is that Jesus was tested. No detail. The Spirit at once drove him out into the desert, and he was in the desert 40 days, tested by the Satan, and he was with the wild beasts. No one knows what that means. Whether it's danger, or whether this is the lamb lying down with the leopard. No one really knows. But there you simply have someone who said that Jesus was tested. They evoked, by the 40 and the desert, they evoked the 40 years of the people in the desert. But not in the very explicit way that we find in Matthew. So what happened then? I think that on the basis of this, that Jesus said to his disciples, "You will be tested as I was tested," that they then looked into their own experience and said, "Well, where am I tested? When am I tested? In what am I tested?" And in the light of that experience, they went looking for similar episodes in the life of Jesus. And that, I believe, is the basis of the parable. I think it's a little unlikely that Jesus parabolized his own experience. He could have done, but if I can see creativity in the early church, then I'm inclined to follow that line. But for the creativity of the early church, remember, they needed one thing. They needed a clue that Jesus had been tested. Then they went to their own experience, and because for them Jesus was fully human, then they looked for episodes in the life of Jesus. And, as far as I'm concerned, there were certainly plenty for them to find. Now remember, the first test is the heart of Jesus. Is it divided, as that of the Israelites during the Exodus, or is it whole? Mark chapter 3, verses 31 to 35. He went into a house, and the crowd came together so that they could not eat. And when his relatives heard it, they went out to seize him, for they said, "He is beside himself. He's out of his mind." And his mother and his brethren came, and standing outside, they sent to him and called him. And a crowd was sitting about him, and they said to him, "Your mother and your brethren are outside asking for you." And he replied, "Who are my mother and my brethren?" And looking round on those who sat about him, he said, "Here are my mother and my brethren. Whoever does the will of God is my brother and sister and mother." Now notice that this is not a complete text. I've let out from verse 22 to verse 30. Because Matthew's or Mark's technique is to start a story, then to divert into another story, and eventually to come back to the original story. That's why it is clear here that the relative who consider Jesus to be nuts, include his mother. It's his relative, who is then identified as his mother and his brothers. And for Jesus, his mother is not sitting with him among the believers, but he identifies female believers as his sister and mother. Now, the situation is perfectly clear that Jesus was considered a nut by his family. And they wanted to get him out of the public view. He was disgracing the family. He is beside himself. He's out of his mind. Now, in the Middle East, even today, the authority of parents is virtually absolute. My dentist in the old city used to be the head of the medical school at the American University in Beirut. And when his mother got too old to look after herself, she just said, "Come home, son." Now he has a small practice in a back street in the old city. But he would have lost all credibility if he had not returned, obeyed his mother's order. Another friend of mine was a lawyer, barrister in England. When his mother got too old to run the family hotel in Jerusalem, he went back to run the hotel. And he had no choice either. Now that's the sort of pressure that Jesus was under. It's not the tension between two goods, but the tension between good and evil. Jesus' understanding of what his mission involved and the demand of his mother. Because, remember, and this is just a parenthesis, that Jesus was not unique. You know, the struggle that Jesus had to achieve clarity in his vocation, that was mirrored in the case of his mother. Because remember that Mary was not at the foot of the cross. This is the only comment of Mary we have on Jesus during his lifetime, is that he's nuts. And he appears at the foot, and she appears at the foot of the cross only in John's gospel, not in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And you think all the others gave a list of women and forgot Mary, the mother of Jesus? Oh, no. She wasn't listed because she wasn't there, because she wasn't a believer. Why wasn't she a believer? Remember now that I'm talking in the context of acceptance of the virgin birth. That Mary had had this experience of God, that Mary knew that her son was special, but that was all. Did Mary then go on to think, as Peter did, well, if God gave him to me as a son, a Bethlehemite, shouldn't he be out raising rebellion, chasing the Romans out, chasing the landlords? What's this wimp doing talking about loving your neighbor and that sort of stuff? See what happens? I'd love to see this total acceptance on every face. Yeah, exactly. No, here there's a very clear text. No, I honestly do not think then, like the brothers of Jesus, it took the great sign of the resurrection for her to become a convert, a follower of Jesus. Then she is a model of faith because she had to struggle for it. It wasn't easy. Because we flatter ourselves to see that our great estimation of the Mother of God, this is just putting people on pedestals. Oh, she had all those special graces, which means we don't even have to try to imitate her. That's your problem in accepting a truly human Mary and a truly human Jesus, is that it puts you on the hot seat. Bert? Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. That is true of the Mary in the post-resurrection period. And had she known then what she now knows, she would certainly have been there. No question about it. Right. I don't think that story is in Luke, is it? I know, I'd have to see the reference. I just can't remember it offhand. Certainly doesn't come to mind. Well, then, you see, to be exactly doing what John did at a later stage, apropos of the crucifixion. You see. And if Luke does that, then it just confirms this interpretation, which is the one taken up by the commission, you know, which wrote that book, Mary in the New Testament. Ray Brown and Joe Fitzmyer, who are not wild men at all, you know. They were forced that relatives really means murder and the brethren. But this, all I want to bring out is this great test, you see. Then Jesus was conscious, you see, of this. How do we know? Because he spoke about it. Another of his disciples said to him, Lord, let me first go and bury my father. But Jesus said to him, follow me and let the dead bury their dead. There, in Palestine, the obligation to bury falls on those nearest to the person. Even to this day, there are no Catholic undertakers or Protestant undertakers in Jerusalem. If you have someone to bury, you do it. No one takes it off your hands. And the responsibility, of course, are those who are most intimately related. This is a very serious obligation. Jesus was aware of the seriousness of the obligation. How? Because I think he experienced it in his own life. The second, the temptation to, or the testing regarding self-preservation. And he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed, and after 3 days rise again. Now here, I have no problem except with the words 3 days. See, that Jesus should have foreseen his death is simple common sense. He knew what had happened to every prophet in the Old Testament. He knew what had happened to John the Baptist. The odds were precisely the same fate was going to overtake him. Then, if you look at the Old Testament, in 2 Maccabees chapter 7, where the 7 Maccabean brothers were being executed because of their fidelity to the law, they proclaimed that there God will have to raise them to the dead, from the dead. Why? Because they died defending the covenant of life, and so God must restore the limbs that were being torn from them. So that if ordinary Jews, convinced that they're dying in God's service, could foresee their resurrection, why not Jesus? The fact of 3 days, of course, is another matter. And then Jesus warns his disciples that they will be persecuted. Take heed to yourselves. They will deliver you up to councils, and you will be beaten in synagogues, and you will stand before governors and kings for my sake, to bear testimony before them. And brother will deliver up brother to death, and the father his child, and children will rise against parents and have them put to death, and you will be hated by all for my name's sake. The third, the temptation, the testing regarding wealth and power. You have that little episode, which is hard to think of as an invention. In John chapter 6, verses 14 and 15, when the people saw the sign which he had done, they said, this is indeed the prophet who is come into the world. Perceiving then that they were about to come and take him by force to make him king, Jesus withdrew to the hills by himself. Now Jesus must have wondered if he could gather people together and with great authority, would he not be more effective? There are two strands in the gospel if you read it clearly. One is Jesus is surrounded by big crowds. That strand I'm very suspicious of, because Jesus was not considered a political threat, either by Pilate or by the king, and in consequence, I don't believe he had a big following. In the other strand, Jesus is tramping from village to village, you know, begging people to listen to him. That, I believe, is the truth, because Jesus' success was so minimal that by the time of his crucifixion, the big mystery is why they even bothered to put him out of the way. Now, it's in this last that you see what I mean by parabolizing experience. That the reality is a crowd of nuts, peasants in Galilee, offer him a non-existent kingdom, a kingdom that was not in their power to offer. Whereas in the story, it becomes the power of evil offering all the kingdoms of the world. The sort of exaggeration that is essential to good storytelling. But that's what I mean by parabolizing experience. And Jesus was aware, once again, of this pull. Why? Because he warned his disciples about it. You cannot serve both God and mammon. Now to sum up, there is history behind the testing of Jesus. It depends on a hypothesis, Jewish, to explain the text that we have, particularly the very short text of Mark and the longer parables of Matthew and Luke. I suggested that they can be reconciled and the possibility of failure raised apropos of Jesus, only if we assume that Jesus told his disciples, you will be tested as I was tested. Then, because Jesus was a man like them, then they looked into their own experience. They saw in themselves a conflict between the demands of family and the demands of their vocation. They saw within themselves the tension between being brave and preserving their lives. They saw within themselves the tension between struggling for a livelihood and a gratuitous mission. Wouldn't it be better if they were wealthy and powerful? And then they reread or restudied the life of Jesus and saw events in that life that they could identify with, that they saw as moments of tension in the life of Jesus when he was pulled in two directions. And then they told the stories, not about themselves, but about Jesus. And I would suggest that there is, in this extremely beautiful parable, delicately, very sophisticatedly constructed, a strong element of historical truth, where even after Jesus had come to the recognition that he was the Messiah, he still had to struggle. He was not protected from the temptations or the tests that are the lot of every human being. Okay? Any questions? I mean, that's very little to do with the testing of Jesus. Oh, well, I mean, there it's all virtual guesswork. Mark in the 60s, the other two in the 80s. The argument for pulling them down 20, 30 years, I mean, it's been tried by John Robinson, that's very hard to prove him wrong. It really depends on a rather subjective estimate of how long it took for things to develop. So they can develop very quickly. Yes. Yeah. Elements that are discrete in the lifetime of Jesus, they didn't happen bing, bing, bing. They were exactly combined and then placed in the desert, you see, to give you the clue that the background to this is Deuteronomy, the experience of the Israelite people. No, the historicity concerns the reality of the test. Yeah, exactly. No. To put it right at the beginning, remember, is for symbolic reasons. That, you see, cross and be baptized in the Jordan is equivalent to crossing the Red Sea, and then an experience in the desert follows after that. And there's a general principle in Jewish tradition. A year in the life of a people is a day in the life of a person. So the 40 years for the Israelite people would correspond to the 40 days in the case of this individual. What? See, as it's formulated, if, then it's a question of testing. But again, we've got to be careful about the devil. How real is the devil? And the problem is that if you look at the end of Samuel, 2 Samuel, I think chapter 24, it is God who orders the census of the people. But when that episode is rewritten in 2 Chronicles, then the census is ordered by the devil, the same census. Why? Why the shift? Because they recognize that the purpose of the census was to create the tax base, and of course taxes cannot be from God. They must be from the devil. There's another episode where, remember when the crazy little episode, Moses on his way back from Midian, that God tries to kill Moses, and his life is saved by his wife. Why would God want to kill Moses? And when you find that story rewritten in the Book of Jubilees, which is the rewriting of Genesis about 200 B.C., it is the devil who tries to kill Moses. So that one is forced to wonder, in Jewish tradition, was the devil a literary device that was inserted when a progressive theology recognized that this sort of action is inappropriate to God, should not be attributed to God. Just as when the heightened sense of the transcendence of God began to root itself in Israel after the exile, then you get the angel of God coming in. Because their problem with transcendence was a history that was full of immanence, that God acted in history. They couldn't deny that, so they systematically went, rewrote the whole text, where the original had God said or God did, now you have the angel of God said or the angel of God did. And read the Annunciation to the mother of Samson, because that was done by a real slob. And he sort of corrected every second line. So it's totally inconsistent. You can't work out who's talking, God or the angel of God. Inevitably, as time went on, people began to think of the devil as a real person and angels as real people. And this created a danger because people said, well, if the angel does the work, let's not bother God and we'll pray to the angel. Now, that was seen by the Jews as a danger to monotheism, and they formally denied the existence of angels. You'll see that if you read through that text in Isaiah 63, the great prayer, it was I who brought you out of Egypt, not an angel. The trouble was, once you start that sort of idea, even if it's denied by the religious authorities, of course, it still remains in the popular mind. That's why it's really difficult as a historian to know whether they really believed in personal devils and personal angels, or whether these were simply literary fictions. I'm quite sure for many they've taught them as genuine people. Whereas, certainly the religious authorities thought of them simply as convenient theological categories with no historical reality. Well, that's typical, you see, because in the quote, in the text from Deuteronomy, it's God. You see? This is simply substitution. You have, you see, not only do you have the angel of the Lord, but you have the Spirit of God acting in history. This is typical. And just as it is God who tests his people, in the later tradition, it is the tester, Satan. Is to focus on the meaning, even if you have to explain the meaning, then people will see the relevance to their own life. Provided you know, the divided heart, self-preservation, and money. I mean, the latter two are easy. It's the first one is the difficult one. But this, to present it as, you know, a magical episode with Jesus confronted with a big hairy beast with wings, that's not very helpful. I mean, the story, they can read that for themselves. It would be read for them before the homily. I think the homily then should focus on the real meaning. It's hard to do the whole thing, of course, all three together. I'd be inclined just to pick on one. Right. No, but yeah, keeping your head down. You know, that you have a mission which might involve acceptance of danger, and that danger can be refused. So that's what it means. For the Israelites, of course, it was slightly different, that God had guaranteed them their protection, but they wanted him to prove it all the time. They didn't trust God. That's right. Exactly. No, because she's definitely outside. Yeah. No, so I mean, to me, it just makes Mary all the more human and all the more admirable that she had to struggle. It also makes the seven daughters a lot more intelligent, you know. They started when he was a teenager, like they do with every mother. No. That's right. I mean, imagine that Mammon is the Hebrew term, and Luke is explaining it for Gentiles. So, I mean, the odds are that Matthew is the more original. Yeah, well, I mean, how many mothers can go to see their sons executed in the electric chair? I mean, if they could, even if they believed he was innocent, most mothers can't confront that experience. So that even if Mary believed in Jesus, you know, would she have been capable of going to the cross? You see, the whole early tradition says no. That's, remember, the very old tradition of the spasm, where Mary, you know, sees Jesus bearing the cross and collapses. And the Via Crucis. So, I mean, they were concerned to explain why Mary wasn't at the cross. They said she saw Jesus being tortured and fainted and was incapable. That's the oldest Christian tradition that is represented in the Jerusalem stations of the cross. Okay? Then tomorrow then we'll have to move fairly fast. So we go through the transfiguration, the agony of Jesus, and the resurrection. So it would be helpful if you would sort of read ahead, you know, be familiar with the text, because we'd have to go a little faster than usual. Three in the morning.